Hi folks, and welcome to episode 22 of the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. Today I'm joined by Bo, and we're going to be talking about the warfare of the Hundred Years' War. Something I particularly enjoy because the English won a lot, and I'm a chauvinist. Bo, I mean, where do we even begin?
Well, there's a lot to say, isn't there?
Yeah.
I would say that after the ancient world, the Hundred Years' War is one of my favourite periods.
Yeah, me too.
Big fan of the medieval period, but specifically the Hundred Years' War. One of the first things to say, it's lasted for more than 100 years. It's like 116 years plus.
And it was like three wars in three separate periods.
Yeah. It's really messy, and there's loads of hiatuses where not much happens for like generations almost. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's a fascinating period. A lot changed over that time, you know, like the warfare as it existed at the beginning was quite different at the end. Historians do like to date it from 1337 to 1453, because of course 1453 is a big year, big famous year, isn't it, when Constantinople falls. So historians love to use that year
as if they're significant, like was it 146 BC with the destruction of Carthage and Corinth,
right? Yeah, you know, absolutely.
They love to use these like mnemonics.
Well, like 1066 is a classic one, but yeah, depending what nationality you are, these years have sort of got different amounts of,
and they could be completely irrelevant as well. But what I find interesting about the Hundred Years' War is it obviously changes the sort of dynamic of warfare from in the beginning being like a sort of French chivalrous warfare to more gruesome and infantry-based warfare by the end of it. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly one element of it, but it seems like there was just a sea change in the way war was done to some degree. So, for example, at the beginning, there's hardly any gunpowder or any guns, really. There are some, but hardly any. And by the end, they're blowing walls down with cannon. Apparently, there was hardly any plate mail at the beginning. Mm-hmm. You'd very, very rarely ever see plate mail. And then by the end, it's not ubiquitous, but it's a lot more common.
Yeah.
And it's a lot better.
Yeah.
Like all designs of helmets and things, changes. And we'll get into exactly what went down.
Yeah.
But from the English point of view, there's sort of three big battles, Crecy, Poitiers, and Agincourt. I think from the French point of view, if you spoke to a French history nerd, French Hundred Years' War fan, they might say differently, because there's a couple of battles after Agincourt that the French win.
Yep.
They boot us out of France.
Yep.
I suspect to the French mind, those are big, important battles, and we kind of skate over them, don't really remember them.
They don't really exist
in the popular consciousness at all, really.
No.
For example, Joan of Arc is sort of as sort of a bit of a funny, weird character who got her just desserts. I mean, that's maybe... But to the French, she's a hero, heroine, rather.
She was canonised in the 20s.
Right.
1920s.
Yeah. The Maid of Orleans.
Yeah. I find it interesting how it took so long for her to become like a national hero.
Mm.
You know, it had to be ideological for the French.
I think actually, just a side note on that.
Yeah.
I think there was a pope in the 20s or the early 20th century that canonized loads of people.
Yeah.
Loads of people. And I think if you look back at the lists, he's sort of an anomaly.
Mm.
Popes before and after didn't really do that. He just was really liberal with handing out sainthoods. Because I think, was it the same one that made Thomas More a saint?
I don't know.
It may have been, but anyway.
Right.
It's like, hundreds of years later, suddenly this guy is worthy to be a saint. You know, an aside. So I suppose we won't necessarily go into sort of much detail narrative of the Hundred Years' War. We want to focus more on sort of
history. At some point, like, you know, a more detailed look at the Hundred Years' War. This isn't going to be the only time we talk about this, I don't doubt. You know, it's the core of the sort of High Middle Ages that we're talking about here. You know, there's so much going on. And so there's no doubt that we're going to have to come back to this just out of necessity at some point. So let's begin with Crecy in 1346.
Okay, yeah. So that is... most people think that Agincourt is sort of the greatest battle. You could make the argument that Crecy is. And it's before the Black Death. Mm. So it's... The populations are bigger and armies are bigger than they are after this, you know, sort of counterintuitively, if you don't take into account the Black Death.
Yeah.
Why is Poitiers so much smaller than Crecy? But anyway, so these first two battles are all wrapped up in the reign of Edward III.
Yeah.
So it's Edward III who is sort of the key figure in this whole generation, and his eldest, most powerful son, the Black Prince. And so, yeah, Edward III had decided that he was going to make a serious claim to be king of both England and France. Just very, very briefly, it all goes back to the Norman Conquest.
Yeah.
Where you had a king of England who's also the Duke of Normandy. And other
French
things, the Duke of Anjou. Yeah,
yeah.
And it's on paper. The vassal of the sort of Capetian kings.
Yeah.
And so... In
They've got no method of enforcing that or anything like that.
Not really, no.
Well, no, not at all. I mean, what are they going to do? Sail over to England?
Yeah, they can sort of get the Pope to excommunicate you, which they did do to King John.
Yeah.
And King John didn't seem to care very much. I think he was quite an impious man, King John. So actually, by the time of John, the English crown basically loses nearly all its holdings in France.
Hmm.
And then you've got Edward I and Edward II, who are very different people. Mm. But it's by the time of Edward III, he decides that it's time to sort of press his claim.
Mm.
And
it, just on a quick aside there,
yeah.
it, like for people who aren't really aware of what like feudal Europe was like, claims and titles and rights were very, very important. And they didn't disappear, even though you had lost access to whatever... province or whatever it is you claim to have. The title was yours by heredity, and then it was up to you, the monarch or the duke or count or whatever it was, to be able to, as you say, press that claim. And so these things sort of existed in sort of theory, in the abstract, unless you were actually enforcing them. And then it was up to you to enforce them, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so you could have, like, literally for hundreds of years, someone has a claim through various, like, you know, different kinds of family tree descent to somewhere they've never been and they've no idea about, you know, and the people have never heard of them. And yet it could still, within a feudal framework, be considered a legitimate and lawful claim to a particular land.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So Edward III will say, my great-great-great-great-great-grandmother, whoever it was, Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Yeah.
So I have a claim on Aquitaine. The crown, my crown, has it should, by rights, by law, control the Aquitaine or Gascony or somewhere.
Yeah. And
it's a long way away from Britain.
Yeah, but, and he's never been there. But by his right of feud, he can go fight for it.
Mm,
you know?
Yeah.
So
One of the interesting examples of that is Henry V. So that's towards the end. Sort of 1415 is the Battle of Agincourt, where Henry V is victorious. He sort of famously in the history, but also in the Shakespeare play of Henry V, he sort of...
Best play, by the way.
Yeah, it's great. He sort of contrives through Salic law.
Yeah.
It's boring. I won't go into the details of it. But he just says, I should still be king of France and England.
Yeah,
and here's
yeah,
the legal
yeah.
reasoning.
Yeah.
And it's really tenuous by that point.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really quite tenuous. It's silly, really.
But the thing is, it's all kind of tenuous. Well, no, it's because... The crown, the authority can't be passed through the mother, can it? It's patrilineal.
Well, that's part of the Salic law.
Yeah. And so this is... So, I mean, maybe it's tenuous. I mean, we could do another talk about that at another time. But anyway, but the point is, it wasn't like it is now, you know? It's you know, these claims can be made very much in the abstract from people who have never seen or been anywhere near these lands, and this was expected to be lawful and true. So it's very different how things are now.
So one of the main things that you had in sort of the 14th century, in as far as warfare goes, is what historians call a chevauchée, which is basically just like a mounted raid into enemy lands.
And let's be clear, right? When historians say there's such a thing as it's the evil plundering English arriving in France and chevaucheeing around the countryside. They didn't do it to us, and I don't think... I mean, did anyone else do it to anyone else? I've only ever heard of this in the context of the English attacking France.
Yeah, they did. They did it to each other, but yeah, the French never sent a force over to mainland Britain and started doing a chevauchee around the south of England. That never happened. But yeah, within the context of the Hundred Years' War in France, both sides were doing it.
Right.
But yeah, we did it the most, and the most successfully.
Yes.
And so a lot of people say...
I'm trying to tell off because they're awful things, but it's just like, we just come off like the villains in the Hundred Years' War.
I say a mounted raid. What it really is rape and pillage and rapine and destruction.
Burning the towns. And the whole point of it is... And I love the hypothetical justification. Well, it proves that your king can't defend you, doesn't it?
Mm.
Therefore, I should be your king. It's like, okay. You know, I mean, I guess that's true. You know?
Shaky logic.
Yeah, it's really tenuous and immoral logic that's being used there.
So it's that thing, God hasn't given your king, doesn't look kindly upon your king, yeah. Otherwise this would never be happening.
Yeah, otherwise we wouldn't be able to burn yeah. and pillage.
Yeah.
So, well, I guess that's true. You know?
I mean, so Edward III is a martial king.
Yes.
Edward I, Longshanks, is a great martial king. Yep. Edward II is a terrible one.
Yep.
And then Edward III, again, is great, sort of in his grandfather's mould.
Yeah.
And so he decides that among the many things, his reign was very long, among the things he's going to do with his reign is to, yeah, try and effectively invade France or lay claim on...
Well,
on,
he has a claim.
Yeah, he's, like I say, he's like, through heredity.
Yeah, from his own standards.
Hereditary claim. He says, you know, we should be dukes of Normandy and Anjou and the Aquitaine and Gascony and mm-hmm. all other things. And there was at the time, there was a bitter dispute over Brittany that we tried to put our oar in and all sorts of things. France looked very, very different. It's a very sort of different landscape, but yeah. we could talk about that, just that, for quite a while, so maybe we'll move on from that.
It's a patchwork of the Capetian monarchy basically owns Paris and the surrounding areas, and they have a network of oath-bound vassals who are essentially like semi-independent minor kingdoms of their own, principalities, dukedoms, things like that, that they all owe loyalty, because everything in a feudal society is bound by oaths. Mm. You know, the oaths are enforced by God. You know, this means that the oaths themselves are incredibly important. This is why being an oath breaker is probably a high crime, you know. It's the sort of thing that gets you chucked out of society. You get cancelled for being an oath breaker. It's a completely different world that they live in.
You are declared nithing if yeah. you break an oath, which means you are worth.
Yeah, I mean, wasn't it after Poitiers that the Black Prince captures the King of France and they take him back to England, and eventually they say, right, go back to France, raise the ransom, and he can't raise it and comes back and hands himself back in, doesn't he?
Yeah, I can't remember if that John does that, but there's I think it is John. There's definitely lots of examples of that, though.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that applied to...
I mean, how honour-bound does your society have to be for that to be the case? Right, so you can let me go back to France, I won't raise a new army, I'll try and get the funds, and if I can't get the funds, I'll just bring myself back and you'll lock me up again. Mm. And like, yeah, that's how it will work. He's like, okay, I guess that's what I'll do. And that's what he does. And it's like, okay, that's a totally different world.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. Well, if your entire position is based upon people's confidence in you,
yeah,
then it makes more sense. And we just don't live in that sort of world, do we?
No.
You know, we live in a world where you can lie to a camera. People call you out for it. It's proven, and no one seems to care. Your career isn't over or anything. Yeah. I mean,
no,
think of Rachel Maddow.
There are lots of people like that, unfortunately.
Lots of liars.
Yeah.
And so Edward III's grand chevauchés through France. There was more than one. And in the end, the French decide that we just can't have this. You know,
eventually they're like, maybe we should do something about
eventually
this.
They decide,
and the thing is as well, one thing you've got to remember is these didn't directly impact the French aristocracy either, because they're in their castles, and Edward's, you know, he's got a force of a couple of thousand men doing the chevauché or whatever. That's not going to assault a castle. It's not even going to fight a field battle, so why would he do anything? You know, not my problem. But of course, then you're like, well, the peasants can't pay their taxes, and, you know, food probably runs short, things like this. And it just starts to look really bad that you are an incompetent ruler. You're an incompetent lord. You know, you can't defend your lands. And so, but, you know, it's not an immediate thing that is pricking them. It's something that builds up over time.
Mm. Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, yeah, it's
the poor peasants just have to suffer. No one cares.
Yeah, right, yeah. God wants them to suffer, it seems, so they will. it seems that, well, at Crecy, Edward III was sort of on the run. There's so many parallels between these three battles. Yeah. And the site of Crecy isn't far from Calais. Hmm. So, I mean, we'll put a map up in post, but it's quite close to Calais, really. It's sort of, you know, not in the middle of France or anything. And... So he'd been doing his chevauché through sort of northern front, through Normandy, really, Picardy and Normandy area. And he realises that the French have sort of raised an army, a big army, sort of in the region of 30,000 men, which is big, quite big.
Huge
still,
for the Middle Ages.
Yeah, right.
But, let's pause on that for a second just to make things clear. So at this time, England is not anything particularly important. in the grand scheme of world affairs. It's just, you know, kind of a damp island that nobody really cares about. Whereas France is like Europe's premier military power, isn't it?
Yeah. Certainly the cavalry, the sort of French chivalry.
Yeah. The cavalry charge because they've got their stirrups, they've got massive lances, and so they just charge forward and crash into whatever is in front of them, and it's a terrifying experience to be on the receiving end of a cavalry charge. You can look on YouTube and just look up videos of, like, you know, 50 cavalry charging in a row, and you can hear it. It sounds like thunder, you know. And so if you have, like, you know, you could have had like 5,000 French cavalrymen all charging forward, the ground would have been rumbling, you know. And if your nerve can hold, then maybe you'll survive, but, like, the chances are you just literally wet yourself and run. I've seen, like, you know, reenactments, and it's just the most terrifying thing.
Just to stand there in the face of a charge from heavy horse,
yeah,
is quite something.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'd be able to do it. I don't know.
Oh, no, I wouldn't be able to do it at all. I would be like, well, why would I do that? You know? Surely I'd just pay my taxes instead. But in addition, you've got the mythos of the French knights, because these men are raised, you know, they're like Spartan warriors. You know, from like 7 years old, they're trained as squires and, you know, and trained into adulthood as knights. And their entire worldview is like this mythic, heroic view of battle and combat. And so that's all they do. All they do is ride around jousting and in tournaments and fighting and, you know, conducting these wars and whatnot. And so they are amazing warriors on an individual level. They're fantastic. You see this in the Crusades when they go to the East and just start beasting the Muslims. Mm-hmm. And the Muslims are like, my God, what's going on? These men of iron, as they describe them. And they're fully armored in, like, you know, heavy mail over a gambeson, which is very, very tough armor. They're incredible warriors and they're insane. They just love to fight. Their entire, like, the self-confidence and sort of the view of themselves is based on warfare. Mm. And that's the cultural sort of milieu they're grown up in. And so these men are basically mental from the perspective of, like, us.
Yeah.
And so they're terrifying. They're incredibly well equipped. They've got, like, it's an entire class that sits on top of France, of these men. And France is huge compared to, you know, England or anywhere else really in this time. And they're, as far as I'm aware, like, they're considered just to be like the tanks of the ancient world, the medieval world. Mm. You know, these guys are the best of the best. And so I always found it really interesting that Edward's like, right, okay, I only need 14,000 men. It's like, mate, France is massive. You know, they've got literally, you know, tens of thousands of these guys. And that's not including their infantry levies and men-at-arms and things like that. Are you mad? Mm-hmm. You know, what do you think you're going to do with 14,000 men? I think it's bonkers.
Yeah, it's something that maybe slightly beyond being brave.
Yeah. And then Edward's like, hang on a second, 10,000 of those are going to be peasants. It's like, that's even worse on paper, you know, what are you doing? That's crazy.
And they're not Englishmen.
No.
So they're inferior.
Well, that's the attitude, it seems.
Yeah. Like you said, a few things there that I think is really interesting. Yeah. One is that France is super powerful and England's sort of a backwater. I mean, yes and no. I would say mainly yes. But there's the idea that a few generations before, in the age of Henry II and Richard the Lionheart, you've sort of got the Angevin Empire. So we were at a sort of a strong ebb at that point. But that's all long gone by the age of Edward III. The other thing is that we talk about sort of the 12th and 13th, 14th century kind of, the high watermark of chivalry. Mm. Now, chivalry, like feudalism, is one of those words that historians will sort of endlessly argue about.
Yeah.
Like, some will say it never existed.
Oh, it definitely existed.
Well, I think so. Others will say, oh, yes, it did.
You read any amount of medieval poetry, you can see it. It seeps through it.
In Kenneth Clark's Civilization, that's Alan Clark's father, not the current Ken Clark, talks about how the Burgundian court, particularly sort of this cultural side of things, that the Burgundian court was sort of considered the gold standard for chivalry at this time. We talk about chevauchés, and there's chevaliers. Mm. It all comes from the French word for horse, really, doesn't it?
Because it's the class of men who ride the horses.
Exactly.
This is all their culture. It's as simple as that. They're weird, and it's a very passionate, mystical, love-based sort of, you know, it's highly emotional. It's all highly emotional.
And knightly orders are very much bound up with sort of a moral good.
Mm.
It's you're supposed to sort of fight for your liege lord, but you're also supposed to protect women and things.
Yeah.
And you're not supposed to just murder people for the sake of it.
Unless they're French.
Unless your king and God have said it's okay to do so. Yeah. But in the normal course of events, yeah, you're not supposed to rob people. You're not. You're supposed to look after this idea of troubadours as well, sort of courtly love and all sorts of things bound up with it. Yeah. It's not just being a tank in battle. There's more to it than that.
There is. Like I said, the troubadours are very interesting. The sort of like wandering bards who go from court to court telling like romantic stories, and it's all very honestly it's quite lovey-dovey in a lot of ways. It's kind of cringe, but like the whole thing is, it just the way I it came across to me when I was reading about it is it just seemed about maintaining this sort of romance that you get when you're a teenager and you first fall in love with a girl. Right, it's that feeling.
It's completely blown out of all proportion.
It's that feeling that the entire...
It's kind of insane.
Yeah, it is. It's totally mental. But that, it's that feeling that the entire class of people are basically trying to reinforce and maintain. And this is why the oaths and the sort of your word is your bond and all that. You know, that's so important. You know, that's the feeling I got from reading it. It's very emotional. I just couldn't get over it.
Well, we're used to a world where you probably have many partners or lovers in your life.
Things like that.
Whereas when back then, everyone's a Catholic. There's been no Protestant Reformation. So you're supposed to... You're not supposed to have sex until you marry, and then you stay with that person forever.
Yeah.
So it's just a whole different thing, isn't it? You sort of have to put them on a pedestal, I would imagine, to some degree, because they are your one and only. That's the idea, anyway.
But it's not. It's not.
You
just
can't
that.
Just discard people, like, particularly.
No, not at all.
So you end up by putting women, courtly women, on this pedestal, really.
Yeah. But also, we're used to sort of English contract law, which means you write a contract, you sign it, and then that's enforced by the courts. That's not what happened in medieval France, you know. So if you broke if you wanted something done, you had to swear an oath, you know, before God and your peers. And if that was broken, you know, you were in a lot of trouble. And this was all like as if it was a group of friends hanging out, you know, and someone had promised someone a bottle of whiskey or something and didn't deliver or something. You know, it's all informal.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.